Thank you for the introduction. And the reason why I'm here on this panel is not just because I've come up with a talk that has got archive in its title, but also because it is, in a way, a follow-up to a talk that was here at Paraflows 1 year ago. 1 year ago, Christopher Poole from 4chan was here to introduce the site and to tell us something about the reason why he believes that 4chan serves as a meme factory. What that is, I'll recap later. And listening to this talk has led me to doing various investigations into 4chan over the past year. Who in this room has never heard of 4chan? That's a very good ratio. You've never heard of 4chan? Okay. Yep. Well, there is going to be a short introduction anyway. 4chan is an image board, and it has a very, let's say, dubious reputation for being, on the one hand, a place where extremely funny things emerge, but also extremely racist and sexist discourse can be observed. And after having dealt with 4chan for about a year now, I think I'm now able to simulate most of its discourse, which I'm not going to try here anyway, but we'll get into some of the reasons why this might be some type of textual and visual discourse that is at the same time off-putting, but also that one can probably relatively easily simulate later. So 4chan is a website, obviously. That is, it's a site of online interaction. And when we look at the discourse about online interaction, we still notice that it is still strongly marked by a distinction between the real on the one hand and the virtual on the other hand. And very often this is linked then with the assumption that the real is also the sphere of the body, whereas the virtual is the disembodied sphere of media. I'd like to contest that, at least from a certain perspective. So my proposition on the one hand would be that online interaction is, of course, always inclusive of the body, as we could not interact online if we weren't also simultaneously physically present, and if we were not observant and did not perceive of the supposedly solely virtual phenomenon that we see on the screen. I'm not going to go into details here, but I would rather then count my perspective to the perspectives of a phenomenologist who believes in the body subject as the subject of perception. And yesterday in Kyle Matulis's talk, we also he gave us some of his ideas how possibly body feedback could be used more intensively in interaction with interfaces, and probably if we had interfaces of the type, or if these were more intensely used, of interfaces of the kind that he introduced, then I would assume that there would also be a stronger awareness of the body subject. Secondly, online scenarios are also very often still, at least in mainstream discourse, described as something that happens while one person is sitting isolated in a room interacting with strangers. We actually know that this is not necessarily the case, certainly not in mainstream social media applications that we all know, Facebook, etc. There have been studies who have shown that people on such platforms are not linked to strangers, but that it's mainly a platform where offline, so-called offline contexts are then mirrored. But apart from this, if we look at platforms such as Facebook, but also such platforms in other forums such as 4chan, we also notice that there's not only just one individual that interacts with code and signs, but there's also a certain necessity that other subjects and individuals interact either simultaneously or asynchronously. Therefore, the results of the overall interaction is the result of a social phenomena. What I'm going to try to do in this talk is I'd like to try and make the entanglement of media technology on the one hand and of social and also embodied practice visible. And I'm going to use a distinction between the archive and the repertoire, which has been proposed by Diana Taylor. Diana Taylor is professor for performance studies at the Tisch School of the Arts in New York. And she focuses on Latin American and US performance and also on colonial and post-colonial conditions of performance. This is why some of the examples that I'm going to use will refer to colonial history. Broadly, this is starting off a bit theoretically, but I'm going to need those terms later in order to describe certain things that that I believe are happening on 4chan. So according to Taylor, we can draw a line between the archive and the repertoire in the following way. The archive, she thinks, or she proposes, consists or is made up of material things, for instance, documents and objects, anything that can be, and this is one of the techniques that the archive applies, can be separated, knowledge that can be separated from the knowledge bearer, if you wish. So such objects belonging to the archive would typically also be inanimate and time-enduring, whereas she thinks of the repertoire as a different kind of knowledge practice and an embodied practice of knowledge. The examples of repertoire practices would be rituals, dances, anything that involves a physical performance and not just of one individual in a particular setup. And different from archive practices or objects, practices of the repertoire are ephemeral. That is, they cannot repeat it in exactly the same way. While the archive then works across time, distance, and space, one might also argue this is one of the features or characteristics of media technology in general. The archive would require presence and that people participate in the transmission of knowledge. So in a way, what is happening right here now is, of course, belonging to the repertoire, because I am here talking to you, physical subjects, and probably if all of you suddenly left the room, I think I would stop talking. I don't think I would keep on talking just for the recording. So, but having said that, that already points to the fact that practices of the archive and the repertoire work in tandem. It is not just that we can draw a clear dividing line and say these practices qualify as archive practices and they will never ever be in touch with repertoire practices. A very good example or very simple example of how these two spheres work in tandem is if we think of a wedding ceremony. With a wedding ceremony, we have, for instance, the exchange of vows and rings, and we also have witnesses, the maiden of honor and the best man in the room who are part of the transmission and therefore attest to it. But at the same time, we also have official documents, which will then later and across time give proof of that particular ritual that that took place here. And what we must also acknowledge, though, is that at least in our particular type of culture that is a literate culture and a culture of writing, documents have a different reputation than of course performative practice. This is a very interesting thing for me, by the way, because I got married 6 weeks ago, and unfortunately we cannot find the documents anymore. They must be somewhere, and but of course, if we don't find them back, if they really got lost, I hope they did not. We also, they're probably in some moving box somewhere, but we haven't been able to spot them. So I haven't been able to go to the German embassy and announce that I got married. I don't think the German embassy would be impressed if I went there and say, can't you see I have a ring? And I can bring my maiden of honor and she'll tell you that I really got married. So obviously in our type of culture, the practices of the archive also have the function of confirming and affirming that certain things happened and give a certain status to particular practices. If we look back at the history, and this is one example that I'd like to cite that that Taylor has investigated, we will also notice that often techniques of the archive have served as instrument to extinguish certain repertoire practices. What you see on the right-hand side are examples of the so-called Florentine Codex. These are 12 books that were written under the supervision of a Franciscan missionary, a missionary to the Aztecs in Mexico, Bernardino de Sahagún. And the codex is mostly actually written in Nahuatl, which is the language of the Mexican Aztecs. One of the reasons why de Sahagún is also considered the father of ethnography is because he actually learned the language. He was accompanied by a team of trilingual students who spoke Spanish, Latin, and Nahuatl. So they documented the religious customs of the people that were supposed to be to become Christians. While this, on the one hand, one notices or one can observe that there was a keen interest on learning about those practices in the 16th century, but at the same time, this was not really out of cultural curiosity, but the need to know stemmed from the need to be able to see or to be able to notice whether heathen practices were already distinguished or not. This is a quote from the first of those 12 books. It is needful to know how they practiced their religious practice in the time of their idolatry, for through our lack of knowledge of this, they perform many idolatrous things in our presence without our understanding it. These books, as you can imagine, were copied among the Franciscans, but of course were not exactly the type of documents that one would have wanted everyone to have access to. And the Holy Inquisition was very worried, actually, what actually was the impetus to document in order to be able to understand what happens, that this was could at the same time be, will actually help to further these practices. And Sahagún also is aware of this, and therefore in the book itself we also, and this seems to be a contradiction, we also read that with great care and diligence you take measures to get these books without their remaining originals or copies of them. You will be advised not to permit anyone for any reason in any language to write concerning the superstitions and way of life these Indians had. According to Taylor, Sahagún did not know that not all the copies were destroyed when he died, but one copy has been preserved. And this copy has been the most rich source in order to describe not just the religious practice, but also everyday life of the Nahuatl people before the Spanish Inquisition. So what we notice here is the interesting way in which archival techniques cut both ways. On the one hand, they were used as and intended as a means to extinguish repertoire practices here being the religious practice of the Nahua. And on the other hand, they also, because the archives works across space and time and distance, they also provided this wonderful document and archive, yes, of the lives then. But what could a repertoire practice, by the way, the Nahua, we should not think of them as an illiterate tribe, but at least according to the research of Taylor, performances and repertoire practices played a much larger role in the cultural practices, religious practices, that is, in schools, there was a strong emphasis on students not just being able to read Knotensprache, a particular type of script made of knots, but also that they'd be able to perform the dances and to recite the knowledge, etc. But question then is, what could a repertoire practice, where could we observe something like a relatively pure, independent repertoire practice, or relatively independent from archival practices? One example that I'd like to present is, and it is absolutely not surprising that repertoire practices these days are in particular found among popular practices. I'm going to show a short clip of the movie Rise that a few might know. It's a documentation about underground dancing movements in Los Angeles, about clowning and crumping. Now, these types of dances, meanwhile, you can also learn them at dancing schools. But the way that they emerged and what is documented in this film is those dances happening and taking place on the streets, in community centers, that is, wherever. Similarly, people do not practice, or do not, these dances do not evolve just on their own, but it's a communal practice. It happens before an audience, but an audience of dancers. So the dance changes and evolves with people participating in it. The clip that I'm going to show is going to end with this particular quote by one of the dancers, where he says, "The style changes every day. Believe it or not, every day the style changes. And if you haven't danced in 2 days and you come to a crump session, we are going to know, we are going to know you've been slacking off." Again, we have the moment of transmission, that is, we have the necessity of people actually coming together to perform a particular embodied practice, to learn from each other and to let that dance evolve, probably in a way that can hardly be described in minute steps. I'm going to switch this on now because it's going to make odd sounds.
Lost it, y'all cats get tossed quick. Newsflash, we the ones that run this mosh pit. I run with a squad of killers that's real hard. How you talking crunk, and you ain't even got no battle scars. We keep the earth rockin', haters be watching, they ladies be jockin', all the chest poppin'. Want this chunk, come get this chunk. You get chunk, you be leaving out the circle with lumps. So glory be to the first cat to worry me. No more passes, your asses is boring me. The comfort stepper on the planet, you can't stand it. Cats are candy, that's why I push the face in the granny.
The style style changes. Believe it or not, every day the style changes. And if you haven't danced in 2 days, you come to a crump session, we're gonna know. We're gonna know. Like you've been slacking off.
I don't think it's going to surprise anyone that after this film, of course, crumping and clowning changed also, and quite a number of the people appearing in this documentary then later became semi-famous dance instructors. One of them starred as a judge on So You Think You Can Dance or Dancing Stars, whatever the name of these shows is. And filming and documenting this, of course, would then, in a way, also once again work together then with this type of repertorial practice. But next question is, how can we apply all of this to the digital domain? I think, first of all, and I think that is obvious, even though as a heuristically, it seems to be very useful to, or it can prove to be rather useful to think about different type of practices as either belonging to the archive or to the repertoire. But then if we look at digital practice, of course, the problem we'd have would immediately start with point, can we think of digital media and digital technology and practices that evolve around this as either material or embodied? We know that information does not have matter, but requires a certain medium in which it is inscribed. And similarly, if we look at embodied practice, the question is, where is the body that we actually want to look at? Is it just the body in front of the computer? Does that really disappear in the virtual sphere or not? And I think that the way that archival and repertoire practices work together in the digital sphere, that this can be well described if we look at the way that 4chan works. So I'm now going to introduce the image board 4chan. It's not a website that you understand right away, and also I don't want to take the risk of taking you there without preparation, so I'm going to use screenshots which are safe for this audience and safe for work. For those who watch this on the recording, don't watch it at work. It's not safe for work, actually, I've just realized. So last year, Christopher Poole talked about the founder of the image board 4chan explained why 4chan is a fertile ground for memes. 4chan is an image board, which means it is a discussion board, but in order to post there, to open a new thread, you have to post a picture. Then follow-up posts may contain a picture or not, but generally the discourse is started with a picture. Sometimes you'll find that somebody posts a picture and then writes, picture unrelated. But nonetheless, it is a technical necessity, and it is also expected from users that they post interesting images. This practice is actually called titties first. That is, if you want people to interact, you have to offer something to them. Very often this happens to be an image of tits. This is why it's called titties first. But the slogan titties first just means any type of interesting image. It could also be a unicorn bathing rainbows. That would also be considered, I think, an interesting image. And 4chan has the reputation of being a meme factory, and in internet language, a meme is some type of visual practice or some type of joke that is repeated and can be easily repeated by lots of different people. One of the memes that is known to have been to have emerged on 4chan are lolcats. That is photos of cats with a caption and with some type of message. Usually the type is the font that is used is Impact, as you can see here. And it emerged from the practice of posting cats on Saturday. Saturday is Catterday. So, and you'll see that, we'll have a look at a few examples, that lolcats are also used as a way to interact with others, as a comment on what has been posted. Another famous, relatively famous practice, web practice, meanwhile, is rickrolling. Rickrolling means you see an interesting link somewhere, or somebody sends you an interesting link and says, check this out, this site is really cool, and then you click on it, and then all you get is this video of Rick Astley singing Never Gonna Give You Up. I think in 2008, all the videos on the front page of YouTube linked to this one particular video. So it has already moved into the mainstream. But it's, of course, it's only those relatively benign practices that make it into mainstream. Another thing that might also be famous is a particular type of collective identity called anonymous. And we'll look at why it is called anonymous. That evolved on 4chan. Anonymous is legion. We do not forget. We do not forgive. Expect us. Anonymous, for instance, was behind the protests against Scientology in early 2008. So that was the first time that mainstream media reported about Anonymous. Now, why is 4chan a meme factory? These were the reasons that Mood offered. The first one was, Mood is Christopher Poole, that 4chan has no barred entry and people can start posting right away. This is probably one of the least important reasons, actually. When he was here, he also said, well, we don't have captures. These days you have to enter captures on all websites. Meanwhile, even 4chan has captures because they had such a huge spam problem. And if you look at the website, I would propose that it's not necessarily a website that is easy to understand, or that you, when you visit for the first time, you would figure out, well, what am I supposed to do here? There are many terms that one wouldn't understand, probably. And depending on which type of forum you use, you're also warned that you have to, where that this website is for mature viewers only. Some people might decide to leave there. And if we look at one of the most popular forums, B, also if we look at the general layout of the website, it is run or operates on money that is made from advertisement, which is either for Japanese online shops or for porn sites. This could also be rather off-putting. So I guess the fact that that there's no barred entry, we'd have to think about this twice. But what is actually the reason why one may speak of the fact that there is no barred entry is that there is no registration on 4chan. That is different from most websites. That is, you cannot create your own account. You cannot go there and say, I'm going to claim this nickname for myself, and this is the name that I'm going to choose, and this is how you're going to recognize me. And this this emphasis on anonymity also has the effect that no hierarchies in the conventional sense can be established on 4chan. That is, normally you have older users have a stronger reputation, and newbies will usually don't stand a chance in an argument. But if you look at the way that a typical discussion, what it would look like on 4chan is, you have anonymous posting, anonymous responding to anonymous, and anonymous responding to anonymous. What I also find interesting about this is not just that, of course, this limits the potential to establish yourself as an old user of the platform, but also this challenges one of the assumptions, or at least of early online media research, which focused on questions such as, what are people like in real life, and what do they appear like, or what do they act like online? Because you can simply not map this. It is impossible. This type of research project would be impossible, but also then for the users, the project of developing an online identity is just as futile. So for instance, you would not, it might be the same person responding to him or herself. You would not know. So to sum it up, you have no registration, meaning that there is no profile page. We usually have some type of profile page on social websites, which is sort of, if you want to look up a user, this is the static representation that you'll find. There's also no diachronic representation, that is no representation across time. On your Twitter account, you can look at the timeline of a particular user, or you can flip through all the things that somebody has posted on Facebook. This would also not be possible because such type of a technique of identity building is not provided. What you have instead is that each of these individual posts has a separate ID. And I think that is actually very interesting, because instead of trying to build, trying to use technology to create one identifiable data set which is supposed to represent one user, you have instead opinions and positions, and you cannot raise questions such as, was this post probably contradictory to what you said earlier, which is a type of argument that you often find in online forums. This is simply impossible. And I think this could also then teach us a lesson on how we conceive of identity expressing itself online. What we nevertheless often notice is that on 4chan, for instance, this is a discussion from the animals sub-board, and it starts cute. Let's play a game of name that animal. That's a red panda, by the way, very cute. And this game is played over and over and over on 4chan, and it always ends up in this type of game, which is identify that animal by its genitals. This is a typical twist of a discussion on 4chan. Sooner or later, it develops a sexist, racist, etc. Edge. Now, why is that? Unlike other websites, 4chan does not have an archive of user posts. This must also be for legal reasons, because even if copyright infringement happens on 4chan, before anyone finds out, the website, that particular content is already going to be deleted. What 4chan does offer is different types of 404 errors. So if you spend some time on the website, because it's such a common experience to find a thread that has expired because it's already been deleted, you get a message that tells you, well, sorry, not found. And yeah, you can spend some time. Don't think I've been able to spot all the 404 messages that you get. And when does a thread expire? This depends upon the popularity or the number of threads. In a forum, there's always a set number. It is not really necessarily known, or always the same number for each of the forums. Which means that on the one hand, if you post a thread, if nobody responds to it, it will sink to the bottom and be deleted within 5 minutes. This is what happens on B, the most popular forum. My threads always disappear after 5 minutes. I'm not edgy enough yet. But on the other hand, if a lot of people respond, this means that the number it will appear at the top, but which will also mean that sooner or later and relatively quick, this thread is going to expire due to its popularity. And this is mood. Interpret this as some type of evolutionary principle. The site has no memory. The crap gets washed away. And if it's a genuinely good idea or something that people identify with, then somebody will save it and repost it, and that's how we get memes. That was the explanation. I'd like to go through an example. This is just one thread, a relatively harmless thread, at least nothing with erotic contact, if that helps. Here we see, okay, now I'll go back. This is an advice animal. This is a type of image that you find relatively often here. It's an advice koala, and people are then asked to offer their ideas of what this advice koala could say. Buy wheat for the first time, return it. So we'll see that, it does in a way evolve. We also see here someone use a lolcat in order to comment that he or she likes that particular thread. What have we here? Send nigger gets on bus, get off bus. This is already an example of a rather racist comment. Now, the conclusion here would not necessarily be that that 4chan is full of racists and sexists, but rather that this particular setup of the site creates a sphere of competition where you have to post outrageous messages in order to get the attention of others. And also, of course, you don't have to justify what you post. And it cannot really be mapped back to one particular person. So in a way, it is, I would think of this as a semiological laboratory for extreme meaning, for extreme opinions, if you wish. Then we have, let me see, there was one particular example. I think I've missed it. Okay, here we have somebody saying, this is definitely OP, being the same fagging faggot. This is not original, so fuck off. Every user, fag or faggot is the generic term used for users on 4chan. And the same fagging faggot is somebody who posts and pretends that he is... does this make sense? Somebody responds to his or her own posts in order to keep the thread alive and pretends to be somebody else, for instance, by saying, oh, this is awesome, or something, or generally just responding. And therefore, the assumption that somebody could be a same fag or that suspicion is always there, and it is repeatedly voiced by users. So on the one hand, we do not know. So there are actually a few interesting ways to still identify in a way or learn something about the embodied subject behind the screen. And one of those practices here is this one, New Facts Can't Try Force. This type of game is played every day. It really does not take too long until you are able to find an instance of users playing that game. And it works the following way. Somebody posts New Facts Can't Triforce. To Triforce means to post three triangles in that particular arrangement. Now, what newbies do is they copy that code, put it in the comment field, and when they post it, it will look like this. Which means that New Facts Can't Triforce, because what they actually should have done, copying does not help, but they would have to know the Unicode shortcut for a non-breakable space. And if you do not know this, you're not able to Triforce. And you see how they're trying to do it. So in a way, this is one of the few and very interesting proofs then of given of actual properties of the subjects behind the screen. Okay, this is just to make it more visible. So to come to closer to the end. So on the one hand, we'll have difficulties then to really put 4chan into either of the categories, the archive or the repertoire. Of course, on the one hand, since this is clearly an instance of an archive because it relies on digital technology, because it does at least for a certain time make content available, because it does separate the knowledge bearer from the knowledge, but then also because in this particular situation we do not have the opportunity to build knowledge about the users in the group, because the users become not identifiable. And on the other hand, you have the fact that everything gets deleted sooner or later, and actually relatively soon. So this means that whatever happens here relies on the participation of the users, and not just in the simple sense, as we could say, well, do media exist if nobody looks at them? That is actually not the question here. But it is not possible to go back to, and next to impossible to just to study the archive in order to understand what possibly has been happening, but instead you have to have users who constantly repeat what happens here. And actually, if you spend some time on 4chan, you'll find that it's the same jokes that get repeated over and over again, and often very formulaic jokes. And in this way, that was my initial comment. In this way, I think I would be able to simulate some of the discourse that can be observed, simply because I've, in the meantime, spent so much time on 4chan. And of course, I mean, how can you draw a line between researchers and users out there? Of course, as soon as you start using a website, you're a user yourself. So, but users counterbalance this deletion routine. They respond to it in that they save as much of the images as possible. This is a nice analogy for it. B, this is one of the forums. B, how do you get your women? Answer, right mouse click, save image. This is one of the basic technologies, cultural technologies for a 4chan user, because the image might have disappeared before you know it. And there's even one forum, which is the request forum. If you saw an image and you missed it, you can go to the request forum and say, okay, this is the type of image, possibly you have a related image. At least you must be able to offer an interesting image yourself in order to get the response of others. And if you're lucky, somebody will be able to give you exactly that picture that you want. I once went there and asked for barfing rainbows. I did not get unicorns barfing rainbows. That's what I wanted. I did not get that particular unicorn, but I got a couple of others, so I have a nice collection of unicorns barfing rainbows now. And this is a precious screenshot that I found on a different forum, not on 4chan. And as you can see here, somebody has an archive of 2.53 gigabyte of images downloaded from 4chan. And this is going to be one of my next projects. I'd like to find, I have one contact already, 4chan users who would explain to me the ways in which they organize their archive, because if you have an archive of 2.53 gigabyte of images, you have to have some sort of system. You can impossibly know all of them, but these images then are these gray archives on the user's computers are what is fed back into the circulation and the transmission. I've completely lost track of time. Apparently nobody else is giving the time either. So, do I still have time?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, good, excellent. Another comment towards the end is that often we'll find that in the discourse about web users that one thinks of a particular website or platform modeling one type of user. A while ago there was a discussion about MySpace users who are supposed to be working class, not so well educated, versus Facebook users supposedly being more middle class, etc. I don't think with 600 million Facebook users at the moment that these distinctions really do make sense anymore. But what I think what one must keep in mind is that of course you do not have just one user who uses one particular website, but it's a set of skills and knowledge that is required for each website. And if somebody behaves in a particular way on 4chan, we cannot necessarily assume that this is also the way that the user would interact elsewhere. What we can identify is a set of other websites which surround 4chan. Websites with a stronger ability for archiving, for instance. One of the most important ones is the Encyclopedia Dramatica, which is something like it's a wiki that documents what happens on 4chan or on the web. It documents memes. It documents things such as the great Habbo raids. If you heard of the Habbo raids, Habbo is a virtual hotel world, and it's happened four times already that users that also organized themselves on 4chan invaded this hotel world. They all went there in characters. What was it called? Negras, that is African Americans with a huge afro, and the aim was to block all the hotel pools, because if you had one character stand in front of the pool, then no other character could enter that pool, and also to align their characters in swastika formation. And that is a typical 4chan thing to do, because on the one hand you think, hey, this is anti-consumerist, I like this. And then what they do is they gather in swastika formation, and suddenly you think, oh, I don't think I understood this correctly. Yeah, but it's very difficult to just put the things that happen around 4chan in just one category. But if you want to learn more about the things that happened on 4chan, then Encyclopedia Dramatica is a wonderful resource. The language is not very much different from 4chan, so it would take a while to actually understand what happens here. And it's an includists wet dream. There are several articles about one particular topic, for instance, and yeah. So this is probably the first circle around 4chan. You have this wild encyclopedia. Of course, the Urban Dictionary would be very important, which is yet another user-generated dictionary, but which has tools such as you can vote articles or down, which typically has the effect that the more offensive ones slowly sink to the bottom, but they don't disappear. And then what you also find, and it seems to me as though these forums, within each language community or national community, there's possibly at least one such forum. That is a forum where users can register and where they can, for instance, also organize face-to-face meetings. So on 4chan, you cannot register. A wiki would not really make sense as to use as a place where users can arrange for real-life meetings. Then I think in Austria, Overclockers is probably one of the forums that is important, which was useful for me because in the beginning I think I need a local guide to help me understand what happens on 4chan, and I through this forum I was put in contact with a very bright informatics students who then explained some of the rituals and practices on 4chan to me. The public off-topic of mods.de, that seems to be fulfilling a similar function within the German community. And last, to sum up, so how can we think of 4chan? We can simply say it's just a hybrid of archive and repertoire, or one could possibly also, in order to have an analytical framework, begin looking at it as a network of distributed agency where you'd have, on the one hand, archival techniques such as hardware and digital technology, where it'd have to take into the account the participation and embodied knowledge of users, and also the different spheres of action, that is the immediate point of contact of the users on a particular website, the human-computer interface, of course, and its particular implication. It's not typically used by more than one user at a time, and I think this is also important for websites such as 4chan, because honestly, while I was doing my research on 4chan, I would not have felt comfortable if somebody would have watched me doing this, because it's sort of what you, if somebody, it is on the one hand a very intimate interface, but as soon as somebody sees what is on your screen, you sort of have reasons to justify. So probably, have you been looking at this type of pornographic image a little too long? Could that be suspicious? There's various aspects that we need to consider, but in the end, I don't think that we'll be able to disentangle this network in such a way that we could say, well, we still have a clear describable sphere of the real as opposed to one of the virtual. So, my last two images, I had completely forgotten about these. So, two things I think justify speaking of 4chan as something that brings to get, that is at the same time an archive and a repertoire. That is the fact that there is the necessity of users interacting, and users who are not just minds but who have very physical needs and whose perception is also cannot be separated from their body. And then on the other hand, you have the interaction of many of such subjects, which might then in the end create something that is much, much bigger than what you can only observe on that one particular website. This is a photograph from one of the protests of Anonymous, that is this collective identity that emerged in the context of 4chan. Against Scientology. And that was it. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thanks a lot. We have time for a couple of questions. And because I have the power of the microphone, I'll ask my first question now. Okay? I remember last year when Moot was here, there was an interesting feeling of like people who came here because they want to see Moot, because they were fanboys primarily, and there were people who did not understand the culture. And it's, of course, it's hard to understand it because, I mean, if you've done a research of a year to kind of find out how it works and what's going on here. And one of the things I remember was a question from the audience. Oh, you have this enormous power. Millions of people spend millions of man hours in 4chan. Couldn't you do something that is actually changing something? Couldn't we have like not 4chan, but 4change? You remember that, yeah? And that was like, and there was an immediate like response from the audience like, ugh. No, that does not work that way. That's like one of the basics actually of 4chan is that it is like an interesting okay, so now my question would be will that change? Will that like how long is such a repertoire sustainable for such an audience, I would call it?
Well, difficult. May I just respond to one aspect that you raised first, because that is going to shed more light on my answer. What I've left out here is that these types of communities aren't actually something new. I would actually, if we look at this collective identity, Anonymous, that evolved or emerged around 4chan, I was pointed to this by an ethnologist, and I absolutely agree with him. It has, it actually has a lot of similarity to so-called mask societies. You might have heard of we've all heard of masking cults of traditional, for instance, African religions, and there you find a distinction between obsession cults, which are typically which women typically belong to, and of masking cults. And masking cults or mask societies are predominantly masculine. And they have, on the one hand, they are. You become a member of a masking cult if you become a man. That is, it has to do, becoming a cult is becoming a cult. You become a cult member through a rite of passage. And if we look it is one of the trademarks then of such a rite of passage that also your identity is stripped, your name is taken away. And Anonymous, of course, is a mask, and we know that they also actually really do wear masks. Members of Anonymous, the guy Fox Max, you've probably seen it. And on the one hand, they have an interesting function, these mask societies, because they may even, on the one hand, they are known for their obscene dances and rituals, but also they may have police functions. And this is something that we also see happening with Anonymous. Therefore, I think, coming back to the question, could this also be why can't we have 4change? I mean, there is change happening, just not your liberal notion of we are only doing the good things type of change, but rather you have a collective that you cannot really control, where you cannot really say, well, we want them to just support the good causes because they will do whatever they want and experiment with rules and semiotic material as they go along, sometimes with an outcome where you'd say, yes, we as good citizens like this. Coming back to the Habbo example, it's anti-consumerist. But at the same time, you'll find that it is not possible to demand from them that they'll only do the good things, because it has its own dynamics. And these types of liminal spaces or passage spaces are something that we'll find throughout human communities. So In other words, even if that particular platform 4chan would disappear, there would be others. That would be my contention. I don't think, and I don't hope that this type of fear is going to disappear. And
that's pretty much like answering my second or third question, I guess. So how long can it be sustained? So how many it does not need to be sustained, because they just like find their own new medium to do that, or their own like the new message boards. Or I mean, I remember that
it's not always the same.
Mood was already working on something like the 4chan 2.0 kind of thing. I'm not sure how far he is, but he was like promising some change or some kind of like new platform or something. I don't know.
I would actually disadvise him from doing that, because I think that on the one hand that the way that the platform works at the moment, it's very important that the users supplement some of the shortcomings of the technology. So I don't think actually that you have to necessarily have to have a posher website or one with more Web 2.0 features. I think
that Mood is too savvy to just like make. I just call it Fortune 2.0.
Yeah.
I think that he's doing like research and thinking about the stuff for a couple of years now. But I'm not sure how long that will take and what will happen.
Yeah.
Okay. But questions from the audience. Yeah.
I am reminded of chat rooms listening to you. I mean, you don't really need fancy ethnographic references. The technical principles you've been referring to are much the same in chat rooms, because you have an ongoing conversation and it's anonymous and it's gone. Only if someone decides to save it as it goes on, it becomes an archive. So my question would be, I'm not quite convinced about your duality about repertoire and archive, because every phone conversation can be taped, and every comment, every street musician can be put on a videotape. So it is easy nowadays to turn some action into an archive, but this does not allow one to talk about the different or the difficult relationship between archives and repertoires, talking about one of those particular technologies.
That is why I said from the beginning that they do work in tandem. I mean, it's a category that is useful in describing things, but I probably did not make this clear enough, but it would not make sense to say this only belongs to the sphere of the archive and that only belongs to the repertoire, and this is an archives of practices of the archive are necessarily evil and of the repertoire are necessarily good. No, it helps us to pinpoint certain things. But in the end, and that's also why the title was 4chan, the archive versus as the repertoire. Because as soon as you try to pinpoint things, you'll just find that it's not that easy. At the same time, I do think that it does provide a relatively useful framework, in particular when it comes to looking at types of online interaction and being able to see the more ephemeral side of it, but also the aspects that are brought in by the users and could only be brought in by the users. Question is, could 4chan be run by bots? No. You would be able to a certain extent to just to simulate what happens. You would have a stream that just goes on and on and on, but I don't think anything new would come into it. This is one thing. And regarding the chat rooms, I think there's a crucial difference, because even if in the old chat rooms, for instance, you still had ways of With the what is it with the who is command, for instance, you could retrieve some information about with IRC chat about particular users. I have it somewhere in my even if it's just the ID here, you don't even have that. And that is the difference. You do not know who is talking. You do not have at one given, for instance, I could not have logged into a chat room if the name that I want to choose is already taken. This is not the case here. This seems to be a minor difference, but I think it is very important because it brings us to a situation where we don't have this thing happening, that particular posts coalesce into one user or the imaginary construct of one particular user, because you simply never know. You might have one user talking to himself all the time, and I think that there's a saying on 4chan which goes, there are only three users on 4chan, me, you, and that other guy. So I think that this is actually a crucial difference.
Okay, I think it was first you, then you, and then you. Okay.
I just have a quick question. Has anybody ever tried to systematically archive 4chan the way that Usenet was systematically archived?
There are, I think there are various screen scraping attempts. Websites that I found, I would not be able to say whether this is there is a systematic archive or not. I would say that it is kind of against the spirit of 4chan. So if you asked Mood to do it, I would expect that he'd probably not be open to that idea. But you have those various websites surrounding 4chan, for instance, the Encyclopedia Dramatica, etc., where some of its discourse is archived. And for research, it can be difficult. I do not know how to do screen scraping. So I tried to, I took screenshots, but of course you cannot search screenshots, which makes it a bit of a pain in the ass than to go through your materials, but at least you're forced to really look at it closely.
I have a question regarding your differentiation between repertoire and archive. And you posed the question that you, how you translate it in a digital domain, and I have problems thinking the repertoire as a digital domain, as you mainly deal with, let's say, tacit knowledge, and which then, by definition, you would not be able to, like in a digital domain or anything which works with binaries, the knowledge I need to be able to encode it, so, and then I can put it into an archive. So by definition, if I use that sort of traditional conception of data, information, and knowledge, and then apply it to what Taylor says, I could never talk about the internet or what's happening on the internet as a repertoire, because everything is encoded. So by definition, it's explicit knowledge. So if you talk about putting it into a digital, putting the repertoire into a digital domain, I think how do you understand that translation?
Because if you're thinking about this in the lines that you've proposed, you're blocking out the user and the reality of subjects interacting. That is why I think one needs the repertoire. I wouldn't use the term tacit knowledge, because tacit knowledge comes from a knowledge management perspective and thinks of knowledge as something that has not yet been made explicit. But embodied knowledge and embodied practice is not just tacit knowledge. It might even also involves things that cannot be made explicit, and it also brings things into play, such as the question of the well-being of the users at one particular time. So I think that once again the repertoire Is that part of this construct here that can not help us to describe the internet if we think of internet as simply something that is encoded or relies on code and protocols and hardware, but something that helps us to think about the practice of the users? I mean, it would probably be more fancy at the moment to simply say, well, I'm going to use the approach of actor network theory and observe the network of humans and non-humans. Maybe I'm just that insistent because the discipline from which I come is theater, film, and media studies. Therefore, I wouldn't want to let completely go of performance.
Yeah, I don't quite understand why you are very convinced by this. Also, like this literature that you pointed out here, I don't know how many literature that you have investigated, and why is this preferred over something else, which I cannot name them. The other thing is about like internet archiving of the various sort, you know, at the protocol, domain, subdomain, and IP level, there are just tons of way of doing this currently, and also even at the IP level, there are some actually very, very major research some people is doing for all this archiving. So why is this method has such great appeal to you? And also you pointed out just now answering the first question that the shortcomings of the current platform. So maybe you can elaborate on this. Thank you.
Okay, why Diana Taylor? Of course, this is always has to do with the certain contingencies of a researcher's life. I stumbled literally upon her propositions in a different context, in a context that had to do with the question of popular archives. And that was a talk by Maike Wagner from Munich. It's as contingent as that, who gave a talk on popular practices. And I, at the time, was dabbling with concepts of liminality as proposed by Victor Turner. Victor Turner is also one of the one of the researchers that performance studies relies on. So, but once again, I never meant to say that archive and repertoire is the one and only way of looking at things here, but instead I think that it provides a useful perspective to describe certain things without saying that there are no other ways of framing the question. It's rather I'm interested in this because I think it does allow me to describe certain things, and particular the type of thing that I don't think I'd be able to look at if I simply focused on the technology side. So once again, if your proposition would be to use a mainly technology-centered form of archive research, then I would once again say, well, but that leaves out that part that is interesting to me.